From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, a feature story news exclusive. The M23 rebels tell our correspondent in Uganda that they're laying down their weapons and abandoning the armed struggle in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
As of today, we end all these hostilities and we ask all our troops to actually get all the troops ready for disarmament.
We'll ask whether peace can now hold. Also today, one of whistleblower Edward Snowden's supporters tells us about his new life in Russia. An historic vote in the US Senate advances legislation banning workplace discrimination. And what's a better investment, the stock market or the Scotch market?
The people I know generally buy two, one for drinking and one for keeping.
That's all ahead on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. A UN representative has announced that the planned conference on Syria, which was to be held this month in Geneva, has been postponed. There has been much back and forth over who exactly would be attending the meeting, including tensions over the possible inclusion of Iran and of members of the Syrian opposition. The UN is hopeful the meeting will still take place before the end of the year. The M23 rebel group says it has ended hostilities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. This comes after the DRC declared victory over the M23. A DRC spokesman says the last remaining M23 rebels have fled across the border or surrendered. Isabel Nakiria reports from Kampala.
The decision to lay down arms by the M23 rebels comes shortly after heads of state of the Great Lakes region issued a final call for an end to hostilities. M23 spokesperson Lawrence Kanyuka says they are giving a peace settlement a chance to solve the conflict.
As of today, we end all these hostilities and we ask all our troops, the chief of staff, the general, and all this commandant to actually get all the troops ready for disarmament, demobilization, and social reintegration.
In a statement signed by chairman of the M23 movement, Bertrand Bisimwa, the group says it's in full agreement with the Congolese government. The two sides had earlier disagreed on an amnesty for top commanders of the M23 and integration. A recommendation of the heads of state summit in South Africa indicated that a peace agreement could be signed in 5 days if the rebels declared an end to the rebellion. This is Isabel Nakiria in Kampala.
Berlin has asked the British ambassador for an explanation after allegations the UK embassy in the city houses a top-secret listening post. The UK's independent newspaper says US security documents suggest high-tech listening equipment is contained in the embassy roof. UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Berlin says any activity of the like reported by The Independent would be against international law. The British ambassador's presence was requested by Germany's foreign minister for a response to the claims, but the UK says it will not give any public comment on the allegations in line with its policy on discussing security operations. A spokesman for David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, says his relationship with German Chancellor Angela Merkel remains excellent. Olly Barrett, London.
A court in Bangladesh has sentenced more than 150 soldiers to death following their conviction on charges of mutiny in 2009. Another 150 soldiers were jailed for life. The revolt began over pay and conditions in the army and spread across the country, leaving 74 people dead. Appeals against today's sentences are expected. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A vast treasure trove of over 1,400 pieces of art Nazis seized from Jewish collectors has been found in a Munich apartment. The $1.3 billion cache includes newly discovered works from noted painters, including Henri Matisse, Pablo Picasso, and Marc Chagall, among others. India has successfully launched a spacecraft, hoping it will become the fourth space agency to reach Mars. The Mars Orbiter mission launched on the Indian East Coast. It is due to reach Mars's orbit next year. Among other things, the mission will search for signs of methane in the Martian atmosphere. And officials are meeting in Luxembourg to resume negotiations for Turkey's entry into the European Union. Turkey's bid to join the EU ran into recent opposition from Germany over Turkey's crackdown on anti-government protests earlier this year. European correspondent Raquel Pimentel reports.
After 3 years of frozen talks over Turkey's accession to the European Union, officials have officially opened so-called Chapter 22 to the process which allows Turkey access to EU regional development funds. Turkey first applied for full membership in 1987, what was then the European Economic Community. Accession talks began in 2005 but have not had much progress. Turkey has long faced resistance from Germany and France, who've been critical of Turkey's slow progress in democratic reforms, in addition to Greece and Cyprus's objections to Turkish control of northern Cyprus. Political tensions increased this year when Prime Minister Recep Erdogan's staff publicly declared Europe to be in a state of terminal decline in response to EU criticism of the Turkish government's crackdown on protests last May. Erdogan expects membership by 2023, but has implied if that does not happen, Turkey may give up the bid altogether. Raquel Pimentel, Brussels.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where a conflict once considered intractable may now be over. The M23 rebel group announced today that it is ending hostilities and is downing its weapons. In many ways, the announcement was a fait accompli, coming after the DRC declared victory over the rebels. A DRC spokesman says the last remaining M23 members fled across the border or surrendered, and claims their weapons have been destroyed. At least 800,000 people have fled their homes since the conflict in eastern DRC began in 2012, and thousands have crossed the border into Uganda, threatening further regional destabilization. African leaders meeting in South Africa on Monday said if M23 rebels publicly declared their insurgency over, then a peace agreement could be signed within days. The M23's media attaché in Kampala, Lawrence Kanyuka, confirmed the rebellion had ended in an exclusive interview with FSN's Isabel Nakiria, our correspondent in the Ugandan capital.
As of today, we end all these hostilities and we ask all our troops, the chief of staff, the general, and all this commandant to actually get all the troops ready for disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration, social reintegrations.
What does this mean to the talks in Kampala? Are you ready to take in whatever the DRC wants you to do?
We've already worked everything with the Congolese government. We're ready to sign whenever the mediator, the facilitator, decided to call the event.
Because the DRC government had concerns with amnesty of some of the M23 rebels. They did not want to give amnesty to some of you. Has that been cleared, and the issue of integration as well?
Yes, as I just told you, everything has been finished. So we're just waiting both parties to actually sign. So the agreement has been between both parties. We had Martin Kobler was there, and the representative of international community who were there as well. So everybody was there. So we signed everything, the agenda, all the points has been sent, and we're ready to sign.
Does this mean the conflict, the root causes of the conflict have been addressed?
The root cause of a conflict, we proposed. We told them our grievance. We told them what it was. And the Congolese government said that we need to stop before we carry on. And the international community said so, that we need to stop hostilities, we need to be political talks and to get a political solution to this, as they always say all along. So we decided, okay, in this case, we have to stop this hostilities and go back to the table, so which we did. So all along, we already signed a unilateral ceasefire a long time ago. But it's down to the international community and the Congolese government to do their part, because the root causes that created the M23 in the first place are not implemented. We are asking them the pacification of East of Congo, the return of refugees, those arms groups that we have for the security of people. So those things need to be addressed. So they ask us to do our part, which we've done. We actually stop our hostilities. We're waiting for them. So we're waiting and sit down to see what they can do, because they wanted us to do that first before they actually do their part. So we have done our part. We're waiting for them to do their part. To be forced is something else. To have the willingness is something else. So you can be forced on something and you don't have the will to do it, you're not going to do it. But we're looking at people. We're looking at the cause that created M23 in the first place. So we have the willingness to actually sit down on the table, discuss this issue, because we can fight with this issue. The war is not going to solve them. You just see now. The war is not going to solve them. The people are still suffering in the moment. It's not only in the eastern part of Congo. You go down to central Congo, you see the same problem. South of Congo, you see the same problem. So there's so many things happening in the Congo at the moment. So we're giving a chance to these people to sit down with us and discuss all these issues. So we haven't been forced. We are willingness to actually to sort these things out politically and have a last peaceful solution to this crisis in DRC.
Lawrence Kanyuka of M23 talking to FSN's Isabel Nakiria. And Isabel joins me now on the line from the Ugandan capital. And Isabel, listening to that interview with Mr. Kanyuka, he appeared to suggest that this is now settled, that the M23 are definitely giving up the armed struggle in the eastern DRC. Do you think it is as simple as that?
It just came moments after the DRC government claimed they had captured the last base of the M23. So we are asking whether were they forced to give up the armed struggle or not. Because it also comes moments after leaders in the Great Lakes region asked them to declare an end to the rebellion and sign a peace deal within 5 days. But the problem here is that they are saying they want to sign the peace deal despite the fact that all the issues in the peace agreement that they had agreed upon have not yet been agreed upon by the DRC government. The DRC government has not yet said whether they are going to give all the M23 rebels amnesty, whether they are going to integrate them all into the DRC. I mean, what they're saying is they wanted them to first give up the arms struggle before that's done.
Isabel, this has been such a violent and destabilizing conflict. What do you think at the end of the day resulted in M23 losing so much ground militarily so quickly?
Everybody is surprised by their move, but at the moment, people at the border, people in Bunagana, where the last military base of the M23 was, are surprised by how quickly Bunagana is picking up. People have begun going back home. They are now saying they are returning to their homes and they want to pick up the pieces from where it all began.
And you're saying that you are seeing the return of refugees to their homes already. So already there seems to be a sense publicly that it is now safe for some people to return to areas that they had to flee.
Yes, it's amazing that after all this time that people have been running away from home, a lot of instability, all is now quiet, and most of the people who had crossed to Uganda are returning to their homes. But many, though, are still in camps in Uganda, and we are still waiting to see by maybe end of the week whether they will all return back to their homes or some will still stay in Uganda in fear that something else might crop up.
FSN's Isabel Nakiria at the end of a very busy day for her in our Kampala Bureau in Uganda. Thank you very much indeed. This is FSN Reports. After last night's historic 61-30 vote in the US Senate to advance legislation to protect LGBT rights in the workplace, senators began debating the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. It's the first time the bill has made it to the Senate floor in 17 years, a fact that many members of Congress praised as a sign of movement towards a more equal society. But some lawmakers and civil rights advocates are worried about amendments currently up for consideration, which would make more organizations exempt from the bill and give them license to fire or refuse to hire someone because they are gay or transgender. From Capitol Hill, FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
To win the support of key Republican lawmakers for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, Democratic leaders are allowing votes this week on a number of controversial amendments. Kentucky Republicans Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell are pushing a provision that would expand restrictions on labor organizing. The measure would make so-called right-to-work laws that already exist in many states cover the whole country. Another amendment from Pennsylvania Republican Pat Toomey would broaden the definition of religious organizations exempted from the law to include religiously affiliated schools, hospitals, and other groups that do largely secular work. But the first measure likely to get a vote comes from Ohio Republican Rob Portman, who explained his amendment to reporters on Tuesday.
Yeah, there are two aspects to it. One is a non-retaliation clause. It says that if a religious entity under ENDA is excluded, that they can't otherwise be discriminated against for, say, government contracts or tax-exempt status. Second, added something about the fundamental importance of religious freedom in the purposes clause of the legislation.
Portman, whose college-aged son recently came out as gay, has become one of the Republican Party's lead supporters of equal rights for LGBT people.
I think there's a general recognition among all of my colleagues that discrimination is wrong, and I believe most, if not all, my colleagues believe you should never be able to fire somebody just because he or she is gay.
But many LGBT and labor rights advocates are voicing opposition to Portman and Toomey's amendments and are instead pushing for measures to narrow the religious exemptions in the bill.
This version of the bill uses religious liberty as a smokescreen for kind of religious bigotry.
That's Gregory Sandano with the Asian Pacific American Labor Alliance, which has been pushing for ENDA's passage for many years.
There's never been a civil rights piece of legislation that includes this broad of a religious exemption into law, and so and thus really making a second-class status for some LGBT Americans. And it's somewhat ironic that that's the case in a non-discrimination bill. We want to be able to ensure that all workers, including LGBT workers, can be free from workplace discrimination, even if they work at a religious institution.
The bill is expected to easily pass the Senate this week, but it still faces an uphill battle to become law. In a speech Tuesday, Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin expressed concern that House Speaker John Boehner wouldn't let the bill see the light of day.
The Speaker has a lot of control in the House. He can decide what's going to come to the floor and what will not come to the floor, and he usually has his way. But if we can show a strong bipartisan vote, even beyond the vote yesterday when 7 Republicans joined the Democrats in trying to end this form of discrimination, then perhaps we can prevail on the House of Representatives.
A final vote in the Senate is expected this Thursday. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now, the fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden made plenty of headlines over the last few days. He was reportedly offered a job in Russia, where he's been granted asylum, by one of the country's leading websites. Twitter was awash with photographs allegedly showing Mr. Snowden taking a tour of the Moscow River. And over the weekend, Republicans and Democrats came together on the Sunday television talk shows to dismiss out of hand reports that Mr. Snowden is interested in discussing clemency with the Justice Department. Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat, and Congressman Mike Rogers, a Republican, on CBS's Face the Nation.
He's done this enormous disservice to our country. And I think the answer is no clemency.
He needs to come back and own up. We can have those conversations. If he believes there's vulnerabilities in the systems you'd like to disclose, you don't do it by committing a crime that actually puts soldiers' lives at risk in places like Afghanistan. You just don't do that.
So what's the reality of Edward Snowden's situation in Russia? I spoke earlier today with Jessalyn Radak of the Government Accountability Project. She saw Edward Snowden in Moscow last month at a dinner during which he was presented with a whistleblowing award.
He was in a very good mood. I think he was really happy to see other Americans for the first time since Hong Kong and to have other whistleblowers who could provide solidarity and advice and support. It was kind of icing on the cake. But he was great. He was very balanced and centered. He looked well. He was very articulate and engaged, so he seemed great.
There's been considerable interest in his activities over the last few days. Word that he's taking a job at a Russian website, a picture purportedly showing him taking a tour of the Moscow River. Is it your sense that he has a fairly sort of normal lifestyle on Russian territory?
I don't think it's completely normal. I mean, all I can say is, you know, there are obviously security concerns, and that's primarily because of U.S. threats against him that continue in terms of people saying he's, you know, should be tried for treason. People, meaning members of Congress and heads of intelligence agencies, joking about putting him on the assassination kill list. And that kind of thing. So there is high security. In terms of the photos, I can't authenticate those. The first one doesn't look like him at all, and the second one looks kind of staged. I really don't know. And in terms of the job, I mean, that's been going around for months that he has job offers or might be working or something like that. But when I met with him personally, My impression was that he was plenty busy trying to learn Russian and acclimate to his new home in Russia and be engaged in reform.
Now, there was also talk over the weekend about possible clemency and whether the United States would ever consider clemency, seemingly prompted by some sort of interaction Edward Snowden had with German officials. What, in your mind, is the case for either clemency or the legal charges against him to be dropped?
First of all, he did not request clemency anywhere in the letter. That is a really, I think, tortured interpretation that the New York Times put out, and that, of course, congressional apologists like Dianne Feinstein and Mike Rogers were able to use to get themselves on the Sunday morning talk shows here in the U.S. Obviously, he didn't request clemency because he has not been indicted, tried, or convicted. The word clemency appears nowhere in there, and he doesn't even address the letter to the U.S. It's to the German parliament. I think that was a way just to try to smear him again, to try to imply that he was guilty or that he's admitting guilt in some kind of way and asking for forgiveness. But in terms of dropping the case, as a general matter, I think the government should drop the case because obviously his disclosures have served a tremendous public interest. Obviously, they've evidenced conduct that's illegal, given that we have bills before Congress right now to try to remedy this conduct. And there's been an unprecedented war on whistleblowers using the Espionage Act, especially those in the national security and intelligence fields.
Now, you sort of just described Dianne Feinstein there, the senator from California, as a congressional apologist. She's generally not considered a sort of raging conservative, and she made the point over the weekend that Edward Snowden could have come to her committee as a whistleblower, provided the evidence that he had, and not, from her position, have placed American national security at risk. Why is she wrong?
She's wrong because I have taken numerous clients to her committee. Numerous clients of mine from the NSA have gone to the House and Senate intelligence committees and reported wrongdoing and not only received no remedy or redress, but then had the government turn around and prosecute them for espionage. So I find what she said completely disingenuous and actual entrapment to encourage people to come to her committee, given the way that it has behaved. In terms of damage to the U.S., the government, of course, says that over and over again in every whistleblower case, but in none of them, including Bradley Manning's, could they come up with a damage assessment or any real example of damage that's been caused.
And, Justin, let me ask you finally, is there any sense of intellectual discomfort, either with Edward Snowden personally or his supporters, over the fact that he has essentially been provided refuge by a Russian government that, at the other end of the country, quite literally, is holding 30 Greenpeace activists, and that is generally not known for upholding and respecting human rights?
I don't think so, because actually he did not choose Russia. The U.S. chose Russia for him. He was actually ticketed on a plane from Hong Kong to Latin America, and the U.S. revoked his passport while he was in Russia, therefore leaving him stateless and stranded. So the only thing he could do was apply for asylum, which he did, and which he was granted. I don't think anyone holds discomfort over that. I mean, there are a number of countries, including our own, that have engaged in quite repressive conduct. Obviously, the U.S. is a prime example right now in terms of the way it's trying to put anyone who dissents, you know, into criminal jeopardy, including journalists, including whistleblowers, including hacktivists, including people in Code Pink, you name it. So I think Russia's not perfect. Neither is the United States by any stretch of the imagination right now. So, no, his supporters are not troubled.
Jessalyn Radak of the Government Accountability Project here in Washington, D.C. Now, in uncertain economic times, people around the world look for safe havens for their money. Back in the 1600s, the Dutch invested heavily in tulips, in what is widely considered the first speculative bubble to burst in the history of the global economy. Today, it is harder stuff that's attracting investors. The global demand for luxury whiskey has been steadily growing over the past 5 years, with many turning to it as an alternative investment, like art, classic cars, or luxury yachts. But will a wee dram of what the great Alastair Cook used to call the twilight wine of Scotland hold its value? FSN's London correspondent Natalie Powell has been finding out.
Those in the industry have renamed the alcohol liquid gold, and with increasing global demand for fine whiskey, it's easy to see why. Investors have been getting a taste for the liquor, with some bottles trebling their value within 12 months. Limited edition and bespoke whiskies are now heavily in fashion in the UK, and not all are made in Scotland. Distillers like the London Distillery Company, the first whisky distillery in the British capital for over a century, has also started tapping into that market. And as Darren Rook, the CEO of the London Distillery Company, explains, whisky can be a lot more investable than other options out there.
Whiskies, it's desirable. It ages really well, and unlike wine investment, where potentially you have corked in, whiskey retains its flavour as a general rule. The people I know generally buy two, one for drinking and one for keeping.
And that's the reason behind why many in the industry are calling whiskey the alternative investment. But putting money in is still unpredictable. In recent years, only the top 10 performers have made returns. Oliver Chilton, head of business development at the Whiskey Exchange, a specialist whiskey retailer, reveals why.
Like any investment, there are always going to be risks. Some products can increase in value, some can decrease. It doesn't happen very often, especially at the moment. The market's very, very buoyant, and we don't see that changing in the very near future. If you invest wisely, long term, the risks are very, very low. But if you just get caught up in a hype, then you might not make the same return that you want.
The Whiskey Exchange's high-end whiskies go for over $70,000. Over the past 5 years, the online retailer has seen a huge demand for the liquor coming from Asia, which it attributes to ongoing growth in places like China, and sales have soared. There's a trend among their online customers to buy not only to invest, but also to drink, the latter driving up prices of fine whiskey even more by reducing supply. And a younger clientele, too, is also another reason why whiskey demand is on the up. Lee Tomlinson, the manager of London whiskey specialist Milroy's of Soho, says the younger generation are becoming increasingly knowledgeable about the alcohol.
Before, we may have had something on the shelf for around 6 months before it was sold out. The more collectible things now don't even see the shelves.
Although there are some risks involved in whisky investment, particularly in the short term, experts see the glass very much half full when it comes to investing long term, and it's a trend that's unlikely to change in the foreseeable future. Natalie Powell, London.
And so it seems sensible to end the programme today with the Pogues and their version of Whiskey in the Jar, albeit the Irish variety. And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme. Our email address, reports@featurestory.com. I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside producer Kevin McAleese, with Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, cheers.